So today we're reading from Canto 8, Chapter 18, Text 12, a translation by Srila Prabhupada. The Lord appeared in His original form, with ornaments and weapons in His hands. Although this ever-existing form is not visible in the material world, He nonetheless appeared in this form. Then, in the presence of His father and mother, He assumed the form of Vamana, a Brahmana dwarf, a brahmachari, just like a theatrical actor. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The word nataha is significant. An actor changes dress to play different parts, but is always the same man. Similarly, as described in the Brahma Samhita, the Lord assumes many thousands and millions of forms. Advaitam achyutam anadi manantarupam adhyam purana purusham puranam. He is always present with innumerable incarnations. Ramadi murtishu kalaniyamena tishtanna navataram akarot bhuvaneshu kintu. Nonetheless, although He appears in various incarnations, they are not different from one another. He is the same person, with the same potency, the same eternity, and the same spiritual existence. But He can simultaneously assume various forms. When Vamandev appeared from the womb of his mother, he appeared in the form of Narayan, with four hands equipped with the necessary symbolic weapons, and then immediately transformed himself into a brahmachari, Vatu. This means that his body is not material. One who thinks that the Supreme Lord assumes a material body is not intelligent. He has to learn more about the Lord's position. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, janma karma chame divyam evam yo vetti tattvatah. One has to understand the transcendental appearance of the Lord in His original transcendental body. Satchit ananda vigraha. Srila Prabhupada ki. So this is a wonderful description of Lord Vamandev. His appearance straight after His appearance. And in some similar way to Lord Krishna's appearance to Mother Devaki, He appeared in an original four-armed form with ornaments and the standard beautiful features of the Supreme Lord with opulence and power. And it's interesting that just as after being requested by Mother Devaki, He transformed Himself into a small boy so He wouldn't be recognized and harassed by Kamsa. So it seems here also that Vamandev transforms Himself into that form for the persecution of His future pastimes. So that's interesting that the Lord is an actor and His appearance in this world is an act. But it's an act of the greatest significance. Normally an actor on the stage does their part. Then afterwards, it's over. He's gone home, the audience have gone home, they've had a good time. Well, Krishna comes. When He comes, He certainly acts, He certainly plays parts. He sometimes plays multiple parts. He delights many people. Paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam dharma samstapanartaya sambhavami yuge yuge. He delights His devotees. He causes great difficulty to the demons. He establishes the principles of religion, or whatever His particular mission happens to be in that particular form. And then He goes. Well, thankfully, that's not the end of it, because His drama, His act, His pastimes are ever fresh and they are ever continuing, because they are written in the scripture. And simply by meditating on these pastimes, we actually have a chance to occupy our mind with something other than the material, materially depressing thoughts of this world. Now that might seem depressing, and you will probably meet many people who would say, oh, this is an unnecessarily negative view of the world. But the thing is, even if you meet the most successful person, And the happiest person, the wealthiest person, the most beautiful person, who feels that the world is just working for them, and everything is going just right, just nicely. Still, their outlook is not the complete picture, because they have ignored a few facts. They've ignored birth, old age, disease, death. They've ignored adidevic, adibhautik, adiatmic miseries, which are constantly assailing them. So in this world, in whichever facility we have, we try to look to the positives, which is good. Otherwise, you do end up depressed all the time. But we should also know that the positives are not the only items in existence. There is the underlying reality, which is great distress, great disturbance, simply because we have taken on board this body. And this body is an opportunity for us. It is ultimately yantra rudhani mayaya. It is an instrument made of material energy. In and of itself, it can do nothing much for us spiritually or eternally. But it has a special quality that this human body in particular comes with it, a special subtle body, which has higher intelligence. And we have the features and capacity to express that intelligence and formulate coherent thoughts, ultimately so that we can engage all of that in inquiring about the absolute truth. So that is the specific privilege, the specific feature of this human body. And when the Supreme Lord, for example, in this form of Vamandev, appears, many fools will make the mistake of assuming that he is just an ordinary person. But as Krishna says in the Gita, janma karma cha me divyam evam yo veti tatvatah tyaktva deham punarjanma naiti mam iti sorjana, that unless one actually understands the divine nature of the Lord's appearance, he has to take birth repeatedly again and again in this world. The moment one actually understands about the Supreme Lord's transcendental position, from that point onwards, his journey in this world of repeated birth and death is surely and surely coming to an end. Either very quickly or after some time, but it's guaranteed. And this is why we have in the Srimad Bhagavatam such wonderful descriptions of the Lord's appearances in multiple different forms. Right at the start of the Bhagavatam, in text 3, in chapter 3, there is a list of different incarnations given. All the different prominent incarnations, 20, 21, something like that. And these are the main incarnations that we hear about, talk about, discuss. But the Lord has multiple appearances. He has actually unlimited different forms in which he appears. In one understanding, we see that the Lord actually appears in every species in some suitable form just for the people within those species. And that's intriguing, but also refreshing, that human life is not the only life, and that the Lord, by his arrangement, has created a whole system of animals, plants, insects, small organisms, as part of his overall system that gives actually all the living entities a chance to carry out their desires and carry out their dreams. That is the only reason why all the different species exist. Because through each one of those different species, one gets a different combination of a facility which is driven by portions of the different modes. So each body gives a different facility to the living entity that then occupies it. And Prabhupada explains that all of these different species exist because that is how many different potential desires and situations there are that we want to enjoy. So 8,400,000 species of life are described. And so that is an amazing construction by Krishna, an amazing design. And it also is somewhat sobering, because that many species of life means that we have that many different types of illusion, types of entrapment to go through. Each one of those bodies that we transit through And we do transit through them. From the human form, if we don't use it for higher purposes, and if we then don't get another human form in the next life, we start degrading subsequently into different animal forms until we work our way through the cycle, burn off, as it's described in the Bhagavatam in the third canto, through that cycle we burn off all the reactions to various sins that we have been carrying out in our various lifetimes. Once we've burnt off all those reactions, we're back again into a higher status, something like a human being. Within human beings also, there are multiple species. But if we just generalize as human beings, then we're back as human beings. And then we have another chance. So we would think that after having gone through this cycle, we're okay now. We're purified. We're ready to engage in our constitutional position. But sadly, that's not the case, because even though we've burnt off the reactions, we haven't burnt off the propensity. So the propensity to enjoy falsely in this world, that remains with us, because that is part of our false conditioning. And that is specifically captured or owned, if you like, by the subtle body, the mind, intelligence, and ego. Each one of those has surrendered to this enemy known as lust in the Gita. And each one of those, including the senses, are acting on the basis of lust. So until that propensity is removed, we simply, through our desires, create for ourselves the next body. And as it states in the Bhagavatam, that when one occupies their entire life earning wealth, a materialistic person preoccupies themselves with accumulating more and more wealth. And it said that that very wealth becomes the ticket by which they purchase their passage to hell. Now that's a very graphic description. All the labor, all the effort that we have put in into accumulating so many things, that itself becomes the ticket by which you enter into unlimited suffering. So through scriptural instructions, we are actually made aware of the fallacy of the principles upon which we operate. Now, it may seem obvious when it's presented in this manner, when there's a scientific understanding of transmigration, the movement of the soul through the different species of life, but it's not actually all that obvious. Most people don't wake up one morning and think, I better do something with my life, otherwise I will be simply transmigrating and suffering in every body. We don't think like that, because that is Krishna's special privilege that he gives us at the moment we try to surrender to him. So there are many different places where the process of surrender is described, but in one sense it starts with a little inkling, a little desire in the mind that I want something better than this. I know what's happening, I've experienced it many times, and I desire something better. I don't even know what it is, or I don't even know if there's a superior power or if there's God. But that is the original inkling, and it may not even be expressed. But for most devotees, that's how it begins. And then Krishna starts to play a part in their lives. And he guides them. He guides them to devotees, he guides them to his mission, he guides them to acharyas, he guides them to persons who will help them move forward. So Vamanadeva, in this appearance, in this particular incarnation, fulfills a specific mission. And that mission's sort of seed was set many, many sort of generations prior to that. There is always a transcendental, maybe not transcendental, but an eternal fight going on between the different competing forces in this world. And especially within the two categories, the demigods and the demons, there is always conflict, where each party is always trying to be supreme, trying to have control, trying to have power. Now, the demigods are naturally chosen by the Lord to be the directors of this universe, to carry out all the different functions, to provide leadership, to provide sustenance. In fact, even in the Gita it says that one should cooperate with the demigods through sacrifice, because through such cooperation, prosperity reigns for all. So there is a whole system of yajna to be performed by more advanced persons, like humans. And then there are obligations from the demigods to supply the necessities like water, air, fire, all of these things, grains. So the demigods occupy those positions. And that is there because they are chosen by the Lord, because they follow his plan. The entire universe follows the plan of the Lord. In fact, the entire universe is created by the Lord, so he can have whatever plan he wants functioning within it. So if his plan is to be executed, he will have his devotees as leaders in that plan. And so those leaders happen to be the demigods, who are very pious persons, who are very capable, very competent. They're not necessarily all pure devotees, because they still have desire for material progress. They still have a desire for enjoyment. But because they try to fulfill those desires by surrendering to the Lord, and they act in accordance with his wishes, they are given those positions. Now the demons, on the other hand, are also extremely powerful. But they act against the Lord. They do things which are utsrija, which are not according to the direction or the plan of the Lord. They don't create a healthy system by which living entities in this world can progress and uplift themselves. Through the natural hierarchy which the demigods maintain, all the different standard practices of surrender, submission, instruction, progress, all of these facilities become available to humans. But when the demons are in power, those things are repressed. Those things are not prioritized. So you end up with priorities which come about due to sense gratification, a desire for sense gratification. Priorities which come about due to a desire for wealth. For all the temporary things which are ultimately not connected to the soul. So this is the reason why Krishna tends to favor in his various incarnations the demigods. Because they create ultimately an uplifting situation for every person in this world to have the facility to move upwards. And that's Krishna's plan. For all the nitya baddha, all the eternally conditioned, all of those individuals who are here in this world, he ultimately wants them back with him. He's created this playground, as Prabhupada describes. This material world is created just as a child is given a playing cradle. That's Prabhupada's term. A child is given a little cradle with toys and things to play with. So this material world is created for all the naughty children, even if they may be adults, who wish to stay and play in this material world. So this world is created, one quarter of the absolute existence, and it's supposed to be a place of reformation. And those living entities who are suffering here hopefully are being reformed also. But the ultimate reformation only happens when Krishna appears and sends his devotee and actually gives someone spiritual instruction. So this fight between the demigods and demons is eternal. It's almost a principle that will continue forever as long as there is a material world and limited resources. And even if the resources aren't limited, what there is no limit to is a person's hankering for more and more. So Vamadeva makes this point later in the story. But initially we have, at this juncture, we have that the demons are victorious. The demons are headed by Bali Maharaj, who is the son of Virochan, who is the son of Prahlad Maharaj. And Prahlad Maharaj, of course, we know his glories as the son of Hiranyakashipu, a family of demons, but still a great devotee. So that demoniac line has continued, and Bali Maharaj is the king of the demons at this point. And Bali Maharaj has conquered absolutely everything there is to conquer, because he has followed the spiritual process, or the correct process by which one makes progress. And that is worship of the Acharya. So through the worship by the demons of Shukracharya in particular, they managed to succeed and managed to displace the demigods from their kingdom. And that itself is a whole adventure which is described at some length in the preceding chapters. Now, this Shukracharya is a very special person, a very learned, very clever individual who knows how the universal systems of power work. And it is actually due to his potency, his yogic potency, that Bali Maharaj is even alive at this point. Because in one of the ferocious battles with the demigods, when a huge fight took place, Bali Maharaj was actually hit with a formidable weapon. And he effectively died. After that particular incident in the battle was over, he was taken by whoever was left in the army to a place where his guru was there, Shukracharya. And Shukracharya brought him and multiple other soldiers back to life by his powers. So this is the strength and capability of Shukracharya. So he's not to be underestimated in terms of his competence. So you can imagine, obviously, Bali Maharaj is very much indebted to Shukracharya. So Bali Maharaj carried on under the guidance of the Shukracharya. He conquered everything. And the demons are ruling happily ever after. However, there's a problem. All the demigods went into hiding. When they realized that there was a formidable battle and their own gurus advised them that you cannot win this battle at this point. Time is against you. Time is against you, the situation is not right, and the demons are exceptionally strong due to their worship of Shukracharya. Better you hide. So that's what they did. They became invisible and they hid in here and there in different places. Essentially out of sight and out of any occupation. They're hiding like refugees. So this is a problem which no one was happy with. And seeing that all her sons were in this lamentable condition, the mother of these demigods, Aditi, comes to their rescue. So once again, mom appears to save the boys from the mess they've got themselves into. And the way she does that is by approaching her husband. Now, Kashyapa Muni is her husband, and he is one of the exalted progenitors, Prajapatis, if you like, one of the Sapta Rishis. He's an exalted person. And he's off performing meditation while Aditi is there in the ashram. And at some point he comes back, and he's not really aware what's happened, but he sees that everything is kind of not quite there. The situation is degraded, there is unhappiness, and he asks Aditi what's going on. And she explains to him, she says, yes, there's been no deficiency in my carrying out of the various duties, there are no guests who have been treated unfairly. All the standard questions, all the standard reasons for why there might be a lack of opulence, some negative situation. And she says, however, the demons are victorious. And although I know that my sons have got themselves into this mess by their own mistreatment of their spiritual masters, etc., still as a mother I feel for them and I would like to see them reinstated in their position. Please make some arrangement by which this can happen. And Kashyapa thinks, okay, here we go again. How strong is the affection in this world? Now, he's had to go through this kind of thing before also, with Diti. Diti is his other wife. And whereas Aditi gives birth to the demigods, Diti gives birth to all the demons. So it's very interesting that the fight between these two parties is actually a fight between the sons of two wives of the same person. Now, initially, when Diti was desperate for a child, she approached Kashyapa. And her method of approach was inappropriate, but Kashyapa lamented at that point and regretted that he had become so weak that he couldn't stand up for the correct principles. At that point, through that union, the demons were born, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. And their appearance is what has set the scene for this pastime. So Kashyapa's thinking, okay, here we go again. There's affection, there's bodily agendas, and once again, I am now being an instrument in carrying this out. But it is still his duty to do the needful, to look after his dependents. So he accepts the situation. And he says, okay, Aditi, I will give you a method and a process by which your desires may be fulfilled. And if we were to summarize ultimately what a universal method which leads to the fulfillment of our goals and desires, what would it be? Austerity. For which purpose? Self-realization, yes, but something more specific? Sri Sri Radha Gokulanand ki. He's just appeared, that's a hint. To satisfy Bhagavan, to enlist the assistance and mercy of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. So that is the process that he prescribed. Just as Dhruva Maharaj was prescribed a process which would gain him the favor of the Supreme Lord, so similarly, Aditi is given a process to follow, which will cause the Supreme Lord to appear and sort out the problem. This is not a simple problem that can just be solved so easily. And so he instructs her in this process, which is called the Payavrata sacrifice, which is a 12-day process, which involves many devotional activities, austerity, penance, strictness, following regulation. There's a lot of description about feeding saintly brahmanas with sweet rice and with different things. So this Payavrata ceremony is very, very powerful. And Kashyapa explains that Lord Brahma instructed this to him many, many, not centuries, many eons ago, kalpas prior. And so he instructs her in this and asks her to begin this at a particular time when the situation is auspicious. And she does that. She follows that to the letter. And then we arrive at a point where after 12 days, once she's completed all the requirements of the sacrifice, the Supreme Lord himself appears. He actually appears in person. Such is the power of not only Kashyapa Muni, but also of this sacrifice itself, and also her great penance and forbearance in continuing with it. So the Lord appears and he has a nice conversation with her, which is in the previous couple of chapters. And he says, I know why you have engaged in this. I know that you are bereft because you don't have any power anymore. You're hiding. You're scared. The demons are in power and this must be very difficult. But don't worry. I will try and help. Although what you are requesting is actually very difficult because the demons have earned their position at the moment through proper means. And although there is no real chance that you will be able to defeat them through any standard techniques, still I will try to make some arrangement. So we know when something like that is happening that the Lord is creating a new plan. He did this when he had to kill Hiranyakashipu. When there is a situation where humans cannot deal with or cannot solve the equation, the Lord has to come up with some new system. And there were so many issues in terms of killing Hiranyakashipu. Cannot be killed in the daylight or the night, neither inside nor outside, neither with any weapon. So many restrictions. Essentially, the ability of any normal person to fulfill or to work their way around that type of benediction, just impossible. But the Lord came up with some technique, half man, half lion, neither inside nor outside, on the threshold, at twilight, neither in the day nor in the night. And he has to do this in different ways. So you can understand that something intriguing is about to happen with the Lord's appearance. And this is also highlights one of the difficulties that the Lord has. That when two parties are there, and they're both dear to the Lord. Now, in one sense, the demigods are more dear, perhaps, than the demons. He tends to side with them constantly. But that's not quite the entire picture. But he generally tends to prefer their priority. But still, in this particular case, within the family of demons, there are certain individuals who are especially dear to the Lord. Prahlad Maharaj, Bali Maharaj. These are actually like Mahajans. And so the Lord has this difficult thing to deal with now. That there are the demigods who are also dear to him. And then there are also these members on the opposite side. And he has to somehow not only deal with the difficult situation itself, but also deal with the nuances of this particular thing. That they are ultimately all his devotees. And so he has to carry out something which will cause some change for one or the other. So that's a tricky thing that the Lord is constantly doing. And he constantly has to do that whenever there's a difference of opinion, which happens constantly within any group. It happens constantly within ISKCON. Multiple devotees trying to serve the Lord, but through their own understanding of what the correct way is. And the Lord has this difficult thing that he can't just get rid of some of them, because they're all dear to him, and they're all worshipping him, and they all want to serve him. So amongst all of those, he has to somehow harmonize all the different options and create a system whereby as many people as possible can work in harmony together. He often resolves most of these issues with great skill and great ability. So in this particular case, he agrees to come as her child. And when that happens, that is of course today's verse, he appears on this Dvadashi, special Dvadashi within the Bhadra month, and he appears like this. As soon as he's born, he has all opulences, all ornaments, and then he transforms himself into the most innocent, unassuming form, a dwarf. Generally, when the Lord appears, he's big, he's strong, he has charisma, but he assumes the most harmless form, a dwarf, and not only that, a brahmachari, a simple student. He has a trick up his sleeve. As soon as Vamandev is born, he appears, he is presented with different items, he's glorified, he's given different items by the different demigods, devatas, offered prayers by Brahma and others, and then he conducts a fire sacrifice himself. Straight away. Once that's done, without any further ado, he wanders over to the arena where Bali Maharaj is conducting a large sacrifice for the furtherance of his own power and control. When kings have a great position, maybe emperors, etc., to maintain that position, they are required to conduct large sacrificial ceremonies in which they worship many ancestors, many personalities, demigods, powerful individuals, and ultimately Lord Vishnu himself. And through that process, they gain the powers required to continue. So Bali Maharaj is there, along with his supporters, and there's a magnificent sacrifice going on. And Lord Vamandev appears there. He appears there, and immediately he's given entrance. Because a simple saintly person would always be welcomed immediately. Bali Maharaj is a very, very great devotee, so he knows the system. And he says to Vamandev, "You have appeared here for some reason. Please tell me what you would like, and I will satisfy it immediately." So Vamandev says, "Thank you," and he then expresses his wish. He says, "I would like from you only 3 steps of land." And Bali Maharaj says to him, "Only 3 steps of land. If anyone ever comes to me begging for charity, they have no further needs in this world forever. I give them anything they need because I am the controller of all the heavenly planets and everything else. So this request of yours is not very intelligent. You are just a young boy and you've come up with this request. You should be asking for something far more substantial than 3 steps of land." And Vamandev says an interesting thing to him. He says, "If a person cannot be satisfied with just 3 steps of land, He will never be satisfied with even the three worlds. Because if a person cannot actually control their desires, they will not be satisfied with anything at all that this world can offer them. He's playing with him in a very wonderful way. Now Shukracharya is sitting there. Shukracharya is the guru of Bali Maharaj. And he's observing this scene. And he's getting increasingly alarmed. Because he has detected immediately who this Vamandev is. That he's Vishnu himself. And Bali Maharaj at this, and Shukracharya at this point says, just be careful what you're doing. Because he knows Bali Maharaj's character is such that he's immediately going to supply whatever Vamandev has requested. And he says to him, just be careful. This person is not who he seems. He's actually Vishnu himself. And he has come here to trick you. He has come here to take everything you want. He's come here to take everything you own. And he has come here because he's always in favor of the demigods, your enemies. So Bali Maharaj was listening to this. And after Shukracharya went through, he was seeing not much response. And he started coming out with different scriptural quotes. He started saying, you may be thinking that you have now given your word that you will give this Brahmana dwarf whatever he wants. But you know, there are certain cases in which it's not required to follow your word to the letter. It's okay to go back on something you've said. There are occasions when this is permitted. And he started giving Shastric injunctions. Now, Shukracharya is described as a seminal acharya. Well, different explanations for this are given. His own appearance is through that process. But also, Prabhupada says he's someone who's looking for the interests of future generations, the bodily concept of life, increasing wealth and situation for future generations. So he's called a seminal acharya. So although he's very competent, very expert, his goal is not pure devotional service and liberation from this world. So Shukracharya is becoming increasingly alarmed, and he now needs to do anything possible to stop Bali Maharaj giving three steps of land, because otherwise his own position is in danger. So he quotes scripture to justify his position. Well, Bali Maharaj is listening to this, and this is his guru speaking. This is his preceptor who has saved his life, has given him everything that he now has given him the means to perform this sacrifice. And Bali Maharaj thinks very, very carefully. He's a very sober, great person. And this episode cements his character forever. He says to Shukracharya, yes, I believe what you're saying, that this may be Vishnu. If it is Vishnu, and our entire life is supposed to be dedicated to serving Vishnu, and if Vishnu wants to take everything away from me, then the service expected of me is to simply hand over whatever Vishnu wants. Ultimately, it simply does not matter if I end up with nothing. He says there is one burden that Mother Earth cannot tolerate, and that is someone that does not speak the truth. She can tolerate so many other burdens, and she does on a daily basis. So much nonsense is conducted on her surface. But she cannot tolerate someone who cheats and lies. And so Bali Maharaj said that I will not break my word. I have offered my word to this dwarf, to this Brahmana, and if he has come here in disguise, then so be it. That is the way it is. We have similar, this is an important notion, and it has been used in the Mahabharata and other places to enact the Lord's plan. If you watch the play at Janmashtami, which they performed, the Rajasuya sacrifice, within that you also have the occasion where Krishna and Yudhishthir, well, Krishna and Arjuna and Bhima, they go. To which demon was it? Shishupal. Was it Shishupal? Jarasandha. That's right, Jarasandha. And they requested him to fight, but dressed as brahmanas. So him, due to his adherence to culture. Although he suspected, he still acceded to their request. And so even amongst the demons, there is this tendency to follow spiritual principles correctly, which is sadly a tendency which is disappearing in today's day and age. So in this way, he says that if the Lord has come to cheat me, whatever he has done, whatever he's here to do, I will succeed. I will carry out his request, because that is the way to actually make advancement. Even if I lose everything, I will have the supreme opulence of truthfulness. And so for saintly persons, that is something they value. For most other people, they will happily neglect truthfulness, happily neglect promises they've made, happily rip up agreements just for the sake of some benefit of their own. Truthful behavior leads ultimately to being accepted by the absolute truth, whereas untruthful behavior may give you facilities in this world, may give you opulence, may give you name, fame, recognition. Again, only by those individuals who themselves are not advanced. If someone behaves truthfully in this world, then the people that glorify them will not be those who glorify others who obtain positions or facilities through lack of truth. The saintly persons always know what to glorify. So even if a person is successful materially and has many followers, many great situations, everyone offers them respect, the persons offering those persons respect are not in themselves of any caliber that makes the respect worthwhile. If respect is offered by a very advanced person, that is valuable. But if respect is offered by a person who themselves are not respectable, what value is it? For someone with spiritual thinking, that is their calculation. Someone else just thinks, I just like being the center of attention. However it comes, whoever gives it, I just like it. That is the non-devotional process. So anyway, this is the fixed determination of Bali Maharaj. So Bali Maharaj says, okay, Vamandev, here you are. Take it. Take your first step of land. Right before everyone's eyes, Vamandev expands himself into a gigantic form, absolutely enormous, so that his one foot becomes larger than the entire earth. That's his first step. He takes over the entire earth. Next step, he's still got two more steps to go. His next step, he conquers all the heavenly planets, right up to the coverings of the universe. With two steps, he's taken everything that there is. Now they're all lost. Bali Maharaj is increasingly worried. I've made a promise. What's going to happen now? The demons are seriously agitated. They've just lost everything with two steps. Their entire kingdom, their fame, their prestige, their wealth. The Lord has appeared and just taken it. And now they're all in great anxiety. Well, the Lord intervenes through the agency of Varunadev, who appears with ropes. Bali Maharaj is captured. You're probably wondering, what's going on? This is a person who's offering everything to the Lord. But no, he's captured. He's bound like an animal. And this is such an embarrassing situation. It's happening in front of everyone, happening in front of all his agents, all his subordinates, happening in front of his wife, which is dreadful for any man to be humiliated and admonished in front of their wife. Bali Maharaj is equipoised through all of this. And Vamandev says, so what are you going to do now? You failed. Anyone who breaks their vow is worse than an animal. This is your situation. What will you do now? Bali Maharaj says, yes, I am the most fallen. I have no ability to even carry out my vow. But I request you to give me a chance to correct myself, correct this mistake that I've made. He says, the only thing I can offer you now is my head. Please place your remaining step, place your lotus foot on my head and accept me as your undeviated, surrendered servant. Yes, essentially Vamandev accepts that. And there's a whole discourse which takes some time. A whole set of actions play out. Bali Maharaj, due to his great strength and character, earns himself a very special place. And he becomes known as one of the authorities of spiritual knowledge. There is this verse in the Bhagavatam, Swayambhu Narada Shambhu, Kumara Kapilomanu, Prallado Janako Bhishmo, Balir Vayasakir Vayam. So Swayambhuva, Swayambhu, who is Swayambhu? Lord Brahma. Narada, Narad Muni. Shambhu, Lord Shiva. Swayambhu Narada Shambhu, Kumara, four Kumaras, Kapila, Kapila Dev, Manu, Swayambhuva Manu, Swayambhuva Manu in this case. Swayambhu earlier means the original person, self-born, who is Brahma. Kumara Kapilo Manu, Prahlada, Prahlad Maharaj, Janak, King Janak, Bhishma, Bhishmadev, Balir, King Bali, Vayasakhi, Vayasakir, who is Shukadev Goswami. So these are 12 persons which are listed in the Bhagavatam as authorities or Mahajans. They are persons who are entrusted with carrying out and propagating spiritual knowledge. Due to his great devotion to the Lord, his strict adherence to truth, despite his entire situation at risk of being removed, Bali Maharaj has actually shown his greatness, just as Prahlad Maharaj did. He has shown his greatness to being a worthy servitor of the Lord. And such a person actually can represent the Lord. So Bali Maharaj attains this eternal fame. And the Lord further blesses him. He says that because you have behaved in such an amazing manner, such a respectable, such an exalted manner, you have put my plan foremost, above and beyond your own interests. I am going to create a very special situation for you. He says, go to this planet Sutala, which is in the hellish planets, in the hellish regions. But this planet, by my grace, will be free from all of the issues that appear even in all the exalted planets. Free from disease, free from pain, free from suffering, free from heat. I will personally come to guard you, he says. If anyone challenges your rule, I will defeat them. With my Sudarshan Chakra, I will destroy them. You can reign there peacefully. Take your entire family. Take all your followers. Go there and be peaceful. Bali Maharaj accepts this. He knows that everything that is happening is according to the Lord's plan. The prominence the demons enjoyed was due to the Lord's plan. The prominence, the loss that they are now suffering is due to the Lord's plan. For a devotee, that becomes the most important factor. Not my own interests, not my own ideas of what I should do while I'm here in this world, but rather a deep desire to follow the plan of the Lord as it's revealed to us by the genuine acharyas. So we are also advised through this episode that when there are individuals, important individuals that we surrender to, that we cooperate with, that we follow, still we're not supposed to surrender our own intelligence. Isn't there, I don't think I'll get the statement exactly correct, but Srila Prabhupada recommended that one is supposed to surrender to the Lord with intelligence, not surrender our intelligence. Right? It means we are supposed to be intelligently serving the Lord. Which means if some individual encourages us to do something which is adharmic, against the principles of religion, as Shukracharya directly stated here, go against Vishnu's plan. We are not supposed to go along with that. We are supposed to be strong and so fully situated in our connection to the Lord and truthful dealings, not just truth, a whole range of other factors which make up a devotee, that we always prioritize the Lord and his plan. Now there are hopefully, in a good situation, very, very few occasions when we might ever have to do this. Hopefully it should never happen that one of our authorities, one of our senior preceptors, will behave in a way which encourages us to go away from Krishna. Hopefully that will never happen. But if it ever does happen, and it has happened in the past, we are supposed to prioritize our devotional service to Krishna. Prioritize spiritual principles, not our own agendas. Prioritize the words of saintly persons, not others who are still acting on the basis of their past conditioning. We're supposed to prioritize in as much as possible and follow those individuals who are serving the Lord as closely and as chastely as possible. That is the way of progress. Mahajana yena gatasapanta. By following the Mahajans, we move upwards. So Bali Maharaj is one of these Mahajans. He is an exceptional person. Ironically, through the appearance of Vamandev, he glorifies Bali Maharaj. Now, Bali Maharaj has gone through a lot. And Vamandev, you could say, put him through all that. That great embarrassment, great loss, great defeat. But through that austerity, through that struggle, the character of Bali Maharaj came out. So the Lord likes to do this. He chooses devotees whom he puts into tricky situations. Because through that, their natural glories are magnified. Draupadi was in a very troublesome situation, being disrobed. But he knew, this is my servant. So when she surrendered to the Lord, that became an emblem of her success forever. Unending fame is created when one acts appropriately in troublesome situations to please the Lord. So that is the wonderful appearance of Vamandev. It is his appearance day today. This is the Dvadashi today. He appears. We have this chance to worship him. We have this chance to understand his principles, to please him, and to be very grateful also for the fact that the Lord has appeared in so many incarnations. He has given us a means out of this world, because by simply meditating on Krishna Katha, we directly create for ourselves our future destination. So that wonderful opportunity is ours. And if we take his guidance and if we follow the example of Bali Maharaj, then our devotional life is guaranteed to be a success. So I'll stop there. Ask if there are any questions, comments.